It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gaffin. Health officials estimate between 7 and 10 million American women suffer from an eating disorder. Since 1985, the Renfrew Centers have been providing clinical care for adolescent girls and women with three types of eating disorders: binge eating, anorexia, and bulimia. Joining me is the director of the Renfrew Center in Pittsburgh, Erin Wentrible. Erin, welcome to the Confluence.
Oh, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Erin, you use what's called the unified treatment model. What's involved in that approach?
Sure. So this is a model that has been developed over a number of years, and actually Renfrew, specific to Renfrew, Renfrew has been actually studying it and looking at its effectiveness. We've recently published some articles in it, so we know that this model works. But basically what it boils down to is that Renfrew treats eating disorder symptoms as symptoms of emotion dysregulation. So we look at any symptom that presents itself in the eating disorder, and we want to know what function it's serving that individual, how it keeps that individual away from feeling a distressing emotion. And we really believe that if you can lean into the difficult emotion, if you can get closer to the emotion without the use of your eating disorder, that you can come out on the other side of that and have a different experience. So we want people to really lean into uncomfortable emotions in treatment. We want to make sure that they understand what specific emotions they've been avoiding via their eating disorder, and we want them to work on feeling those things in a more healthy way.
Right. I mentioned the three, the binge eating, anorexia, mm-hmm. and bulimia. Would you briefly describe how each differs from one another?
Sure, yeah. And so there's three main overarching categories for eating disorders. Anorexia is really characterized by significant restrictive eating patterns, continued decreased consumption, despite significant weight loss. So you have somebody who's really inflexible and rigid in their eating patterns, someone who continues to lose weight despite and that it's never enough. They usually have a preoccupation with weight, shape, and their body size, and can sometimes, but not always, present with excessive exercise. Uh-huh. For bulimia, this is somebody who has repeated cycles of out of control eating. This means that they feel like cannot voluntarily stop on their own, and typically followed by a purging method. Usually that can be self-induced vomiting. That can also be purging via laxative or diuretics. It can also be purging via exercise. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is binge eating disorder. And binge eating disorder is eating large amounts of food, feeling out of control. The difference between bulimia and binge eating disorder is typically is not followed by a purging episode. But these people eat when they're feeling not physically hungry, eating at a rapid pace to the point of feeling uncomfortably full.
All right. So do you treat both physiologically and also emotionally? And are they always tied together, those factors, when it comes to an eating disorder?
Yeah, so there's a definite holistic approach that we treat women who come through the center. They meet with the dietitian. So we're addressing the food piece, but really it's not all about the food. It's really about the emotional work. So our dietitians are trained in the model as well. So they know that the part of the prescription or the treatment is food and getting back to a normalized relationship with food, whether you're restricting it or whether you're over eating the food. We want to get back to a sort of a renegotiation with your relationship with food and being aware of the health effects on the body that an eating disorder has. But it's so much about the emotional piece and the emotional work. And so we really put those two together.
Mm-hmm. We don't feel well, we seek medical help, we go to the doctor, whatever. But how personal, how difficult of a challenge is this to seek help for an eating disorder?
Yeah, it's hard. We've treated women who have been suffering in secrecy for years and years. This is across the board a disorder that is based in shame and guilt and largely misunderstood. So, you know, you're fearful that if you come out and say you have an issue with food, or you feel like you can't control how much you eat, or you feel like you can't eat at all, the solution that people often give is like, oh, just eat, right? That there's this, like, it's that simple. You just go out and you get yourself something to eat and you'll be fine. And so people really hold back from reaching out for help because they feel like they won't be understood. Mm-hmm. And there's so much shame, particularly in binging and particularly in binge eating, that it's a lazy person's disease, or only, you know, people who are overweight. And so, you know, they don't, there's a shift in our culture recently where we've seen and we've treated it more because it's starting to be talked about, and it just got legitimized in the DSM, right? That up until the DSM-5, binge eating wasn't even a disorder.
Explain what that is.
The diagnostic statistic manual for any mental illness.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a new version of that that recently came out where binge eating was added to it as an actual disorder. And
just recently or the most recent
in the
version?
Past couple of years. Yes, yeah. In the okay. most recent version. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I think it's starting to be sort of unshrouded, and but I think it's still so much based in shame and it's so misunderstood. It's hard for people to reach out.
You've used that word shame many times in
yeah.
just the last minute.
Yeah.
How much is that shame and sort of generate felt from within? How much of that shame comes outwardly, you know, from people projecting that on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a big part of it. And I also think that there's this sense in the eating disorder community of people who suffer from this illness that they're not sick enough. No matter what they do, they're not sick enough to go seek treatment. And we want people to know that if you are suffering in any way, if you're limited, if you're isolating in your life, if you can't feel like you can go out and enjoy your life because of something, your relationship to your body or your relationship to food, that you are worthy of seeking treatment. There's this sense that I'm not sick enough, so I don't need to seek treatment. I don't need to get an assessment. And we want to sort of clear that up and say that you can if you feel like it's impairing you.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned a minute ago, you know, they wouldn't understand. Somebody wouldn't understand. And yet, what is the program, the treatment? Does it involve sort of a community, a support group within others who are suffering the same eating disorder?
Yeah.
Or suffering eating disorders?
Yes. One of the things I love so much about Renfrew is that it is a community-based program. So if you come into treatment at any center, from residential and into outpatient groups within Renfrew, so the running the gamut of level of services, you are joining a community of women who are suffering from similar issues that you are suffering for. So immediately you join that community and feel less alone because you're surrounded by women who understand and get this. So much of the programming or the treatment at Renfrew is group based, but they also do some individual work. So it's a mix of those two things.
Right. People listening maybe have a picture of who is this person. Maybe it's a teenager, a young woman, 20 or something.
Sure.
But you also have a program targeted for women, 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a common thing, eating disorders, within women of those age groups?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a strong misconception out there that this is sort of the affluent white woman in their early 20s that's suffering from anorexia. And what we know is that this disorder does not discriminate. So, you know, you can be any age. We've treated women from 14 all the way up into later in life in their 50s and 60s, so that we know this pops up at any time in people's lives and often follows the trajectory of their life in different ways.
And briefly, does the treatment differ with the 30s and 40s and 50s as opposed to the teen and the 20 somethings?
The conceptualization of the disorder is still the same. It may differ a little bit in terms of who you involve in treatment. One of the very important aspects of treatment at Renfrew is having support people involved. So with an adolescent, we want to really hone in on parents. We want to make sure that they are involved and understand the treatment and can support the adolescent through treatment. Somebody who's later in life who maybe has lost some supports, we want to direct our attention to whoever is going to support that person. But the treatment stays the same.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Erin Wentrobel, director of the Renfrew Center in Pittsburgh. Erin, you studied clinical psychology. You've earned a doctor of psychology degree.
Mm-hmm.
Was running a clinic like Renfrew? I think you've been there almost 2 years.
Yeah.
Is that something that you saw yourself doing originally?
Yeah. This is kind of a dream job for me. I started out my career as a bachelor's level clinician working on an inpatient unit for eating disorders. Just by chance, that's the job I landed. Not necessarily an interest back then, and really fell in love with the work, really fell in love with being able to meet people where they're at in a really difficult spot in their life, and people who feel really misunderstood and really disconnected, and just be with them in that journey. And so for me to be able to, you know, go back to graduate school and then come back into this position and be a part of Renfrew, which was is one of the leaders in eating disorder treatment, I am so proud and so happy to be. It's definitely part of where I definitely saw myself.
You recently held an art exhibit.
Yes.
So what role does art therapy play in the overall program of healing?
Yeah, so it's a huge part. So all the way up from residential to what we do here in Pittsburgh, there's art, expressive arts therapy is always a part of the treatment. And so it allows for another kind of outlet. So if you have a difficulty talking about your emotions, if it's not your sort of forte to get into individual therapy and just spill your guts, art therapy is a way to do that, right? So you might get a blank piece of paper and someone might give you an open-ended prompt, and you don't know what comes out, but something pours out of you that is related to some sort of inner emotional experience. Mm-hmm. So it just creates a secondary outlet for people who have a difficult time talking about these things.
For some people, considering treatment for an eating disorder to be something maybe of a privilege, because you gave us that image of a privileged young white woman, not something that many can afford. So how do you work with people who can't afford it but need that treatment just as much as another?
Sure. We have, we are contracted with most of all of the insurance companies. So you can use your insurance to seek treatment for an eating disorder. And we have a whole insurance department. Renfrew is housed under one large patient information center. So if you're interested in treatment and you want to know if your insurance will cover it, how much you'll have to pay out of pocket, all you have to do is call 1-800-RENFREW. You will get connected to the insurance department where they will run an insurance check. They'll give you exact information about if any out-of-pocket costs you have. So really, the hope is that you're able to use the insurance that you have. If you don't have insurance, or if we don't, for some reason, accept your insurance, Renfrew has a foundation that will help sponsor your treatment. So there are many ways that we can get you into treatment if financial issues are a barrier. And that is my goal as a site director, is to be able to get people access to treatment.
We have less than a minute, and I wanted to ask you, you mentioned shaming before, both internally and externally coming and projected on the individual. How does social media exacerbate the problem?
Yeah, we certainly talk about it in treatment all the time, that social media is sort of a highlight reel. And if you end up using your time to compare yourself, you're going to fall short because you're only looking at people's highlight reels. So we definitely know that there's an interaction between social media and people's way that they view themselves and their self-esteem and self-efficacy. So we want to make sure that we talk about that in treatment and limit people's, or just encourage people to set boundaries for themselves around social media. It's feels important.
Psychologist Aaron Wentrobel is the director of the Renfrew Center in Oakland that helps young women with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. Aaron, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. A grand jury report released last August indicated some 300 priests sexually abused minors in Pennsylvania dioceses. Some survivors of abuse by nuns say they've been ignored. And Pittsburgh native Chuck Cooper broke the color barrier in the NBA when he was drafted by the Boston Celtics. Now he's been posthumously named for the Basketball Hall of Fame. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Is President Trump fueling an oil and gas rush on public lands? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. Federal courts have halted the Trump administration's plans to sell oil and gas leases in the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans and on public land in Wyoming. But companies are still racing to drill on these lands. So what does this look like on the ground?
Chaos. Lots and lots of chaos.
Rachel Levin is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. She traveled to a busy oil and gas field in southern New Mexico, where companies are drilling on public land. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, I talked with Levin about what she found.
One of the most powerful moments for me was when one of the ranchers pointed us to this development on this large swath of land that he also leases for ranching cattle. And he said, we're supposed to be notified before this kind of development occurs on land we also lease. And in fact, that never happened to that day when there was all of this development already in front of me. There were tanks. There was a big water pit going in. That really encapsulated to me that there's just so much development and there is a real difficulty in keeping up with even the administrative parts of those tasks of managing it.
Were you able to tease out why it was so hectic and so chaotic? What do you think the factors are?
We are amidst an oil and gas boom that has basically been propelled by opening up these new markets for us to send our oil and gas products. And beyond that, just the staffing of the agency was skewed. I mean, there were significantly more people out there working on oil and gas operations as opposed to managing any of the other resources in this super diverse desert area. Those same people who were trying to manage these other resources also had to clear all of the oil and gas permitting activities. People were just overloaded left and right, and it just made it really hard for them to do their jobs.
We also know that this is a time when the Trump administration is sort of pushing this energy dominance theme. Did your reporting show any of that playing a role?
Definitely. Early in the Trump administration, President Trump had signed an executive order that basically said, look to the jobs, look to the benefit of the economy when you are looking at federal actions. And that executive order has actually been cited in some of the actions of this field office in how they choose to use that land, whether they are proposing to open up more of it, for example, to oil and gas drilling. They say, well, it's in line with this executive order that there will be X number more jobs. There's also smaller actions that have taken place in the state field office that are harder to attribute to the Trump administration on the whole, but definitely have occurred during the Trump administration that make the process of oil and gas leasing in this area less transparent to the public and offers less opportunities for public comment. If you talk to the oil and gas industry, they'll say, well, there are plenty of opportunities for public comment. But if you talk to conservationists, ranchers, and others, they'll say, these are missed opportunities for us to find out that development could occur in these areas and to make sure that the process is done correctly.
Rachel Levin is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. There's more at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On a street corner off Penn Avenue in East Liberty sits a large but unassuming gray building. It houses one of the most popular language learning programs of the digital age. You might recognize its logo, a green cartoon owl. As part of our Built in Pittsburgh series, 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis takes us behind the scenes of Duolingo.
Nos interesan ambos restaurantes.
Duolingo is a language learning website and app that made its public debut in 2011. 84 different language courses are available for English speakers and non-English speakers alike. Luis Von Ahn, the co-founder and CEO of Duolingo, grew up in Guatemala, where he says the disparity between those with money and those without is stark.
In most countries, knowledge of English means that you can make somewhere between 25 and 100% higher salary. So it really is directly related to how much money you make.
In 2009, Von Ahn had just sold a company to Google, and financially, he could sink his teeth into whatever he wanted to. He says he and his co-founder, Severin Hacker, wanted to make something that would give people equal access to a language learning education. A mission was set. For Duolingo to always be free.
We realized that most of the people trying to learn English in the world were not very wealthy. I mean, most of the people that were trying to learn English were doing so in order to get out of poverty.
Duolingo's program is set up like a game. The user translates sentences or speaks into a microphone to repeat phrases. This sound means you've answered a question correctly. This sound means you need to try again. A user gets points for completing lessons. There's a virtual currency, and you can compete with friends. Von Un says keeping it fun and competitive is a key part to the app's success.
When you're in an app learning something, it's just so easy to go and scroll on Instagram instead. So we came up with the idea that the way we were going to keep people motivated was to make it feel like a game. So our hope is to get people hooked on learning as they are hooked on, you know, social media.
There's a whole team at Duolingo that's responsible for language program development. The team includes specialists in certain language categories. But Cynthia Berger, a linguist at Duolingo, says there's not always a team member for every language they develop.
This is where volunteer contributors come in really handy. And these are people around the world who are really excited to help develop some of these courses, especially for things like Navajo and for Irish.
These volunteers are vetted by the language team. They need to be fluent in the language and able to commit a few hours a week to translations. There's no financial compensation for being a Duolingo contributor. Berger says the motivation tends to be emotional.
In the case of Navajo, we have Navajo speakers who want to preserve the language that they speak and the language of their family and their ancestors.
Keeping Duolingo funded has been an evolving challenge. Von Un says the first few years, the company made no money. They were supported by venture capital.
About 2 years ago, we decided we probably should make money, but we were in this pickle that we really have made a commitment as a company that it will always be free to learn on Duolingo.
So they had to come up with a new business model. They started putting an ad at the end of every lesson. Von Un says they had enough users at that point that they generated millions of dollars with just that switch. Next, they added an optional paid subscription to Duolingo, which turns off ads. It also gives users access to lessons without needing Wi-Fi or data.
Very quickly, we started making more money from the subscription than from the ads. And by now, probably something like 80% of our revenue comes from people subscribing.
Von Un says the funding puzzle hasn't necessarily been solved. He says things are constantly changing for the company, and that's okay.
It is a continually evolving project. Not only are we evolving how we're making money, but we're also evolving how well we teach. We're evolving how fun Duolingo is. We're always testing new things.
According to Von Un, hundreds of millions of people have tried the program. Duolingo currently has 28 million active users. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last year's Pennsylvania grand jury report was one of the most sweeping investigations into sex abuse in the Catholic Church. But like nearly all similar investigations, it was limited only to priests. For Keystone Crossroads, Laura Benshoff reports, survivors of abuse by nuns say they are swept aside in the ongoing search for justice.
When Trish Cahill was 15, she says a nun took interest in her.
She got my phone number from my aunt and uncle, my parents' phone number, and she called and asked if I would play guitar in a hootenanny mass.
This was the 60s.
So Peter, Paul, and Mary and whatever, and I really didn't play the guitar.
Cahill now lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She grew up in a big Irish Catholic family in northern New Jersey, where attention from a nun was considered flattering. The two became close. She says the nun offered to be her spiritual leader and started holding her hand in public. Then, one day, she invited Cahill to a shore house and slipped something into her tea.
And she took me into the bedroom, where I passed out. I don't really know what happened that night. I mean, I do know what happened that night, but I was not conscious. I was not able to make a decision.
Cahill says the nun, who was 20 years older, was part of her life for the next decade. During that time, she began struggling with drugs and alcohol. Today, she's sober and living in a friend's guest room. She pulls out bags of photos and slides that she's kept, reminders of what she can clearly see now was abuse.
See how long my hair is? Because she told me she wanted me to wear my hair long. Wear these, get these glasses, don't hang around with this person. She just controlled my life.
Victims of abuse by nuns have gotten far less attention amid the larger Catholic Church abuse scandal, but the watchdog group Bishop Accountability has compiled a list of about 100 nuns nationwide who have been credibly accused. Mary Dispenza is a former nun who is critical of church hierarchy. She says convents have been too slow to call out abusers in their ranks.
In a religious community, this truly becomes your family. It's a dynamic that keeps the secrets going.
As a point person with the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, Dispenza said she's heard from more than 60 people alleging sexual abuse by nuns since the Pennsylvania grand jury report came out last August.
Survivors went looking to find their stories listed among those shared in the investigation, and they weren't there. They've actually made calls to ask, why aren't there more stories? Can my story be counted?
Part of the issue is their stories aren't counted. The PA grand jury report didn't investigate nun abuse. And the Catholic Church considers sexual abuse by nuns or religious order priests, like Jesuits and Franciscans, as separate from abuse by its diocesan priests. But survivors like Kate Finnegan, who lives in the Poconos, say those distinctions shouldn't matter.
She told me that she loved me and that God was love. God is love. And that this was the way that she could best express her love for me, which was very godly.
Finnegan says she was raped and abused in high school by a nun who taught Spanish. She says it was a disorienting time. She herself hoped to be a nun, but she couldn't untangle her faith from the abuse.
We prayed together one evening, and I was praying to God to make her stop.
Finnegan says it wasn't till her late 30s that she began to see what happened as anything other than her own fault. By that time, it was too late to take legal action. For that reason, advocates want victims of both priests and nuns to have increased opportunities to sue. But that requires changing state law. In the meantime, victims of nuns can only turn to the religious orders themselves for compensation. That's what Finnegan did, and she says she got some money for therapy. So did Trish Cahill.
They settled for $70,000. Which the lawyer got a third of.
In a statement, the Sisters of Charity say they investigated and substantiated Cahill's claims and removed the nun from ministry. Cahill, though, is far from healed. To cope, she often spends hours a day writing about her abuse on Facebook.
We are an invisible minority. People are not paying attention to us unless we shove it in their face. So I shove in their face for 8 hours a day.
Cahill says it's her way of openly confronting the culture that silenced her. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Laura Benchoff.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. In 1950, Chuck Cooper became the first African-American player drafted by an NBA team when he was selected by the Boston Celtics. The Pittsburgh native was already a star player for the Duquesne University Dukes, scoring more than 1,000 points during his college career. Now Cooper has been selected as a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame class of 2019. For the Confluence 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley spoke with Cooper's son, Chuck Cooper III.
Chuck, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Katie.
What was your reaction to the news that your father was going to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame?
Just pure elation and joy. It just really means the world to me, my family, and all the supporters of my father's legacy that his contributions to the great game of basketball are being recognized at the highest level.
Growing up, did you have a sense of what your father had accomplished? How did he talk to you about breaking this color barrier?
You know, I was aware, but he was a very modest person, so he didn't talk about it much. But you know, I guess I was, it was brought to my attention whenever we would go out in public together. You know, I always enjoyed hanging with my dad. I was his only son and had three sisters. And a trip to the store would take, you know, a trip to the store to get a loaf of bread would take 30 minutes to get out of the store because, you know, so many people would come up to him and talk to him. And he was somebody who always really loved people. And he would always take time to talk with them. So it was just the attention that he got outside of the house that as a young person, I began to know that there was something special about him.
So, former Boston Celtics owner Walter Brown famously said of your father that he didn't care if he was striped, plaid, or polka dot, but that Cooper was the most talented player in the draft. How do you think your father helping break that color barrier has contributed to the NBA today?
My father, Earl Lloyd, Jackie Robinson, and the early African-American pioneers felt a great sense of responsibility. They didn't want to do anything that would mess up opportunity for others to follow. So to know that he accomplished that he had a successful career on and off the court, he got his master's degree after the NBA. I think he set a great example for all those to come and follow in his footsteps.
After his basketball career ended, Chuck Cooper continued to fight for equality by leading anti-poverty organizations in Pittsburgh and advocating for the education of young Black students by serving on the city's school board. Then later, he was the first African-American to lead any city department when he was appointed head of Parks and Recreation in 1970. Having already accomplished so much during his basketball career, he could have just stepped away, could have retired. But why do you think it was so important for him to pursue this next path?
Well, he came from great parents. Both his parents were formally educated at a time when most African-Americans were not. They really instilled the importance of, giving back to the community and community service. But, he was just somebody that was caring and compassionate about other people and, really wanted to do what he could to make a difference for those underserved populations.
The Chuck Cooper Foundation has provided scholarships to dozens of students. Duquesne University is naming its new field house after Cooper and retired his number. And of course, he's received honors from multiple NBA teams over the years. What do you think it is about your father's story that people continue to identify with?
I think whenever you're a trailblazer and you're the first to do something and people recognize that, it took great dedication and a sacrifice to get there and to be successful at that level. And we're just so happy that our legacy partners like the NBA, the Boston Celtics, and the Duquesne University continue to help us keep my father's name alive. To have an opportunity to honor an extraordinary legacy and provide a teachable moment in basketball history is a beautiful thing. Just like the world knows about Jackie Robinson of Major League Baseball, it should also know about Charles Chuck Cooper of the National Basketball Association.
That was 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley talking to Chuck Cooper III, whose late father, Chuck Cooper Jr., was chosen for the Basketball Hall of Fame class of 2019. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Brandon Flood is Pennsylvania's new Secretary of Pardons. Earlier, he served 9 years in prison for drug and firearms convictions, turned his life around, and was then pardoned by Governor Wolf. One of Flood's goals is to streamline the pardon process. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.